Welcome to Division 5 of the Court of Appeals. We have only one case on our docket this afternoon, and that is Amica Mutual Insurance Company versus First Bank of Boulder. Each side will have 15 minutes to present their case. We do have a lighting system. When the light turns yellow, there's 5 minutes remaining. When the light turns red, your time is up. If you do want to reserve some of your time, the appellant, you may do so. If anyone in here has any cell phones, pagers, please turn those off so as not to interrupt the argument. And if the parties are ready, we may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Mike Plocky. I'm an attorney with Rothgerber Johnson & Lyons here in Denver, and I represent First Bank of Boulder in this case. Our position is simple, that the trial court erred in entering judgment against First Bank in this case because, first, First Bank was not a party to the case at the time judgment was entered. Second, because it was not a party to the case, First Bank was not subject to the court's jurisdiction when the judgment was entered. And third, because judgment in this case was entered on a claim that had previously been dismissed by court order with prejudice. I think the invalidity of the trial court's judgment is highlighted by the mere fact that First Bank was required to intervene in this case in order to challenge the judgment that had been entered against it and to prosecute this appeal. It was completely outside the boundaries of the pleadings when judgment was entered. We think that violates due process.
Counsel, would you pause for a moment? You've articulated three related but similar grounds here.
Yes.
Do you believe that there are meaningful differences in the relief that you would acquire under these grounds, or are they would all just coextensively give you a vacation of this judgment?
I believe they all coextensively require a vacation of the judgment, yeah.
Mr. Plocky, if Amica could get no interest other than what AmTrust had because of the subrogation rules.
Yes.
And First Bank purchases that interest in a 120.
Yes.
Then doesn't that moot everything? I guess maybe it's a bad question. If First Bank now has AmTrust position by virtue of having paid for it in a public foreclosure proceeding, why would you intervene?
Because the court entered a declaratory judgment that stated that any proceeds we received from the foreclosure sale would be paid over to Amica up to a maximum of $282,000. So there was a judgment sitting there that we felt we couldn't fairly ignore.
Isn't the time to contest it when someone tries to execute and you take the position that it's void?
I think we could have done it that way. Frankly, Your Honor, given the fact that the sale to the third party was pending, we didn't want to be put in a position of holding on or retaining the proceeds from the sale in violation of the court's order. It was sitting there, and we thought it most prudent to challenge that judgment at the time.
But by intervening, you then become a party in the case.
For purposes of challenging the validity of the judgment, that's true. That, I don't think, changes the fact that at the time the judgment was entered, First Bank was not a party and was not subject to the court's jurisdiction.
But as I understand it, it wasn't any kind of limited appearance. In fact, I don't think you can make a limited appearance in Colorado.
Well, that was, I'm not sure the law on a limited appearance. We did intervene for the sole purpose of challenging the validity of the judgment, whether it was void or not.
All right, sir.
Counsel, while we've had you interrupted in answering questions, I perceive that your colleague here has argued that, after all, your motion is filed only under 60B5, the merits, I guess, of your argument would be properly lodged under 60B3, and therefore you basically picked the wrong horse. Would you respond to that argument?
Happily, Your Honor. As I think we made clear in our reply brief, and there's a detailed chart with citations to the record, we made all of the arguments that we have raised in this appeal below. It is fair to say that the motion that we filed, the pleading, was denominated as a Rule 60B5 motion, and I think relief is clearly appropriate under Rule 60b-5 as well. But we made all of these arguments below. The trial court considered each of these arguments, and I believe they've all been preserved. A bit of history in this case, a factual history, which I know is unusual for an appellate argument, but I think it's helpful here because I think it highlights for the court a couple of important facts, one of which is that Amica was in a position to avoid this entire conflict and failed to take the steps necessary to do it. As you know, the lawsuit was filed against the insurer, the Haverlands, as well as the lien holders back in 2007. When Amica made its payment under the policy, all of the money went to AmTrust. First Bank got nothing, and that's the point at which First Bank was dismissed with prejudice. There's a citation in that stipulation for dismissal to the Constitution Associates case, which I think is telling here. Constitution Associates, as the court knows, states that when a declaratory judgment action is proceeding, it's necessary to join all interested parties in the case. Further holds that the court cannot enter a declaratory judgment against entities or persons that are not a party to the case. That was cited in the stipulation to make clear that because First Bank hadn't received any of the money, it was no longer a necessary party. It no longer had an interest in the claim, and that's why it was being dismissed. What's equally telling about that reference, however, is that the trial court did precisely what Constitution Associates says it can't do. It entered a declaratory judgment against an entity that was not a party to the case. So I think that's an important reference.
Mr. Plotkin, I do have a question about that. Amica has asserted in their brief that there is a distinction in the controlling cases between when a party has never been a party to the case and when someone has been a party to the case, had notice of the res of the case, but then was later dismissed. And I would like to hear your position on that.
I don't think that distinction holds, Your Honor, when a party is dismissed with prejudice. In other words, is the claims against it are essentially discharged and conclusively resolved, which is what happened here. At the point we received the letter from counsel, which I think is the fact that you're referring to, at that point we knew that Amica was claiming that they had a right to pursue these subrogation claims. We also knew that those claims had been conclusively resolved. In other words, that letter was something of a hollow threat, if you will, and was a nullity. There were no claims to preserve, and we treated it accordingly. So I don't believe that distinction holds on the facts of this case.
Is it potentially the case that the dismissal with prejudice fairly liquidated all the then available claims, which I think were grounded solely on your rights as the junior lienor, but that post-dismissal, your client engaged in conduct that could potentially give rise to new claims that might be available?
If that were in fact the case, Your Honor, and I don't agree that those facts do exist, but if they were, the appropriate procedural mechanism would be to file new claims,
action. Agreed. Okay. But just so it's clear that there necessarily are aspects about this case that we aren't going to decide.
I agree. I think this is a narrow issue before you, which is whether the judgment that has been entered can withstand scrutiny. It's interesting that you note other potential avenues of recovery. Amica, in this case, has avenues of recovery against the Haverlands, and we filed a motion to supplement the record where they are actually seeking relief against the Haverlands in terms of a monetary reward. They also have a claim against AmTrust. What's interesting is AmTrust has not appealed the trial court's judgment, which is entered against AmTrust as well as First Bank. AmTrust, as the court will recall, not only received the $280-some thousand from Amica, it also received $250,000 roughly from First Bank in the foreclosure sale. And so proceeds have been paid to AmTrust, which is properly subject to collection, I believe, by Amica under the terms of the existing judgment, which AmTrust has not challenged. I highlight that simply to show that Amica is not without a remedy if this court sets aside the judgment vis-a-vis First Bank. I was talking about this timeline, and the key point is that First Bank and AmTrust both get dismissed from the case with prejudice before the judgment enters against the Haverlands. At that point, this foreclosure action had been initiated, and Amica had knowledge that the first, that the foreclosure action was moving forward. When they got their judgment against the Haverlands, they didn't take any action to file a recorded lis pendens against the property to reflect that they believe they had some interest. They didn't liquidate or pursue or obtain a judgment against First Bank and or AmTrust until December of 2008, which is after the foreclosure sale had closed and First Bank owned fee title. That tells us two important things, I think. First, Amica could have avoided this dispute at numerous junctures in the proceedings. First, if it didn't want to dismiss First Bank with prejudice, it shouldn't have done so. If it wanted First Bank to remain a party, simply be excused from further proceedings and be bound by any subsequent judgment, it could have done so. And we cited some cases in our brief where courts have done precisely that. That's not what happened. If it didn't want AmTrust to be dismissed conclusively with prejudice, it shouldn't have dismissed them. If it intended to, once it obtained judgment against the Haverlands, it could have filed the lis pendens, which I mentioned a moment ago. It didn't do so. And it could have had judgment entered against First Bank or Amica or AmTrust before the foreclosure sale had gone through, which it didn't do. The judgment, had it pursued this judgment before the foreclosure sale, let me be clear, would have still been invalid, but at least it would have brought this issue to a close before the real estate process had moved forward and title to the property had been obtained by First Bank. Second, I think this history shows the prejudicial effect of Amica's conduct. First Bank had a $99,000 lien on this property. It foreclosed on the property in an effort to mitigate its losses like any good bank would in this current economic crisis. And if you set aside the trial court's judgment, it would have reduced its loss to about $70,000. It still would have lost money, but it reduced its losses by $20,000, $30,000. The problem now is if the trial court's judgment is upheld, First Bank, who didn't receive a dime of money from Amica, has turned a $99,000 loss into a $350,000 loss. So the equities of this proceeding also clearly favor First Bank, particularly in light of the fact that Amica had all these opportunities to avoid this process as we went down this path. I believe that's all I have. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless the court has any other questions.
That's fine. You have about 3 minutes and 20 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mark Honhart of Gregory R. Giamatti and Associates, appearing on behalf of Amica. Initially, I'd like to address two of what I think are the main points in this applicable to this appeal. The first is a point that has totally been ignored by First Bank in their argument to this court, and that is that fundamentally this issue involves a real property issue. The trial court judge recognized it and said as much. Now, this in Colorado, this is a race notice jurisdiction. You're allowed to rely upon the written record if you're an interested party with no knowledge, actual or constructive, about interest in the property. That is not First Bank. First Bank knew all about the issues involved in this case. They were served with a complaint. They answered the complaint. They actively negotiated a $282,000 check made payable to AmTrust and First Bank. They actively sought and obtained their dismissal from the litigation with the express understanding that the court would still retain jurisdiction to make further orders consistent with what happened in the trial court.
Well, this is not the court isn't going to retain jurisdiction over a party who's dismissed with prejudice.
Well, that's right. It retained jurisdiction not specifically over First Bank, but over the property that was at issue in the trial court.
Great.
So for First Bank to say that it just relied upon the record the written record to say that there was no recorded interest against the property would be to allow First Bank to effectively put its head in the sand and pretend that it had no knowledge, disavow any knowledge. This is not what a bank, a mortgage holder, the kind of sophistication that one would expect from that type of entity. They had actual notice of Amica's interest, which was repeatedly brought to their attention. And now for them to say for the first time in this case that Mr. Johnson, who represented First Bank, received a letter and now considers it misguided puffery or a hollow threat or a nullity is simply to create new evidence based upon attorney assertion alone as to what Mr. Johnson was thinking at the time. There's nothing in the record to suggest that Mr. Johnson took any action, that he sent a letter back to say that he disputes the position of Amica or to intervene at that point in the litigation. They could have done any number of things. He chose not to do anything.
Mr. Honart, recognizing that everyone is on notice of the facts here, wasn't Amica required to go down to the 120 and bid in its interest, which is only the interest that AmTrust had?
I'm not sure if there's anything in the record to suggest that Amica was given actual notice of the foreclosure, that it was provided notice by the public trustee's office to that effect, that it had the opportunity to put in a bid.
Well, in the absence of notice directly to Amica, wasn't AmTrust required to give its subrogee notice of the 120?
Well, I agree that there's plenty of blame to go around to AmTrust as well. AmTrust should have, there's a lot of things that AmTrust should have done, and it did not protect Amica's interest in the property. There's no dispute that AmTrust Bank is the entity that accepted the entire proceeds of the $282,000. I agree with that assessment, and that frankly is what raises concerns about the civil conspiracy aspect of this, that both AmTrust and First Bank, knowing the facts, knowing what Amica paid, knowing that Amica was assuming the position of AmTrust as a first lien holder on the property, somehow managed to work this out so that the party that gets shut out of this is Amica.
But you didn't raise that claim.
We have not done that, no.
So let me just be clear about this, counsel. I think I understand your arguments, but don't they really inform further litigation? They really aren't before us, or at least before us is the validity of this particular judgment. And isn't it true that this particular judgment purports to bind First Bank, essentially based on its rights as the junior lien holder, when First Bank was no longer a party? How can this judgment stand?
Well, I guess I disagree with that assessment to this extent. The court was passing judgment based upon Amica's interest in the property, regardless of who purchased it. And it relates to AmTrust's interest in the property as well as the first lien holder to the property. I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
Well, I think you did. I just don't. I'm maybe missing a link here. Let me try to paraphrase it. I think you are saying that because Amica was, by the court's determination, subrogated into the rights of AmTrust, apparently on the day of the payment, right? And not necessarily on the day that the jury returns a verdict finding that the homeowners were at fault. That because of that then perfected interest, all the subsequent conduct the court could just sort of take notice of and render and reduce to judgment purporting to bind now AmTrust's successor, and say that because First Bank now is the senior lien holder, it has to pay out this money. Am I accurately tracking your reasoning here?
Yes, but First Bank paid off AmTrust with full knowledge of Amica's interest in the property and their payment to AmTrust.
And so that's a potential claim that you could raise before a court and have litigated?
Yes.
Okay. It was not before the court in this proceeding, was it?
It was not.
Okay. So how is it that the court can enter a judgment saying, okay, that's the result of this litigation?
I'm not sure that as of the date that the declaratory judgment was entered, that there was any information that that agreement had been made and that AmTrust had been paid off. So I'm not sure that issue was even ripe for the trial court's consideration at that point.
Okay. So but which way does that cut now in terms of the validity of this particular judgment?
Well, I believe that the trial court's judgment remains valid.
Okay.
Mr. Honart, to follow up on the timing question of that, once the interest was sold to First Bank, didn't that extinguish Amica's rights?
I don't know how to answer that. I don't think that it did, but it's not something that I'm prepared
to. How could its rights survive the transfer of the deed?
Only as in the sense that at that point, Amica is subrogated to AmTrust interest, whatever it was, to the extent of the payment to AmTrust.
So you might have a claim for constructive trust against AmTrust.
Right.
All right.
Yes. Yeah. There are potential claims out there, and those were mentioned in the trial court. But at this point, we were just talking about what the motion to vacate the judgment based upon Rule 60b-5. So if the parties are brought back, if the judgment is vacated, then by Amica's view, the entirety of the declaratory judgment is lifted, and Amica can reassert those claims against AmTrust Bank and First Bank for the civil conspiracy, the constructive trust, and so on.
Yes. Okay. Now, once again, to come back to this notion of the chronology of events, if this occurred prior to the judge, the district court entering a judgment, what does the judgment affect? If the interest is expunged, title is passed, the deed is now in First Bank, what is the judge doing?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite track that as to what.
Well, if this occurred before judgment is entered, once the declaratory judgment is entered, declaring rights among the parties that frankly don't exist, what effect is the judgment?
Well, if the transfer of the deed happened before the declaratory judgment, I would agree with that there wasn't a declaratory judgment to be made, or not to the effect that the trial court made, but there's no evidence in the record that supports that.
Granted.
Mr. Honhart, I would like to go back also to the validity of this judgment, but based on the dismissal with prejudice. And as you know, Foothills Meadows states that a dismissal with prejudice is a final judgment and ends the case and leaves nothing further to be resolved concerning the dispute between the parties. And in this case, the court's judgment resolved a dispute between the parties. So I would like you to address Foothills Meadows in regard to the court's judgment.
Well, other than that one statement of the law that exists out there, Foothills Meadows is so totally dissimilar to this case. Foothills Meadows involved two parties disputing a judgment that neither of them were originally involved in the case. There were two attorneys fighting over a splitting of attorney's fees related to Foothills Meadows and the other party in the case, which was Myers. So these two attorneys come in after the case has been decided, and they want to argue about the split of attorney's fees. I'm not sure that that has anything to do with the issues in this case. Foothills Meadows and and Myers were not called in to respond to anything or be bound by the judgment.
All right, so my understanding is because we had a party to the action that was during the action dismissed with prejudice, that is the distinguishing factor?
That's correct.
Counsel, one last question from I don't know if it's the last question, but one further question. Am I correct in understanding that you have asserted that perhaps your colleagues here may not be entitled to relief under 60B5 because the underlying assertion here really has to do with court's jurisdiction? It would be available under 60B3.
Right.
Okay. Now, my research has disclosed that courts very often say, well, if it's available under 60B2, you can't raise it under 60B5 because 60B2 is subject to a 6-month time limit, and we're not going to extend it artificially by allowing you to bring it under 60B5. But motions under 60B3 are not subject to that 6-month limitation. And so then I'm thinking that the distinction between arguments under B3 and B5 may be more exchangeable. Do you have any authority, any cases that would support the proposition that relief under 60B3 could not be raised under 60B5?
Well,
does my question make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. There's a couple answers to the question. The first thing, and that's to correct counsel on one of his representations, Rule 60B3 does not appear anywhere in the trial court. They did not ever assert Rule 60B3 as a basis for seeking relief from the judgment. They only sought it under 60B5. Now,
the underlying arguments are there, right? So we're talking really about the headline that we're putting over the story. Okay.
Right, and that's their own headline, too, by the way.
Agreed.
As to whether I guess my position would be that 60B5 is a special rule. It says 1, 2, 3, and 4 provide relief from judgment. If none of those apply, only then can you go under Rule 60B5. And they haven't explained why 1, 2, 3, and 4 don't apply in this case. And in fact, they repeatedly make reference to the judgment being void, which is right out of Rule 60B3. And this is the first time in this court that they have wanted to assert this Rule 60B3 void judgment argument. And the reason, so the time issues aside, I think the fact that the Supreme Court has created a rule that creates these different boxes and says you only get to go under 60B5 if none of the other boxes applies to your case. And that's what they haven't done, and that's what the argument of Amica is here, that they did not meet the requirement through Rule 60B5 to show the extreme and extraordinary circumstances necessary to get relief from that declaratory relief judgment.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a couple of follow-up points. First, I fear that this case has the potential to set Colorado procedural law on its ear. I'm very troubled that if a dismissal with prejudice no longer means that the case against the party who is dismissed with prejudice is now over, if that's no longer the law in Colorado, which Amica seems to suggest, the certainty that comes along with a dismissal with prejudice through settlement or other forms of resolution is very much called into question. Dismissal with prejudice means and has always meant the case is over, as Your Honor pointed out, and that's what it meant in this case as well. I also feel compelled to point out, to respond to counsel's suggestion, that there is nothing in the record to suggest that First Bank agreed to remain a party, either nominally or otherwise, and be bound by subsequent rulings of the trial court. The record is clear that First Bank was dismissed with prejudice. There were no conditions attached to that, and I want that to be clear for the court. Judge Graham, you pointed out this issue of what interest does Amicus subrogation lien attach to, if anything? We agree, as we pointed out in our papers, that that interest attached to the lien of AmTrust. It was an interest that was claimed through the AmTrust interest. And by the time that was sold, and which occurred after the claims against AmTrust had been dismissed with prejudice, there was no longer anything for that lien subrogation interest to attach to. So we agree with that point. I do want to return to a question that you raised, Judge Graham, regarding the timing of the intervention. And I left out one important point that I'd like to make now on that. I do want to point out that when we intervened to challenge the judgment itself, we weren't given the opportunity to challenge the merits of the subrogation claim. At that point, when we intervened, our only option was to challenge the procedural technical validity of that judgment. So we have never had an opportunity to defend the merits of the subrogation claim, which I think is an important distinction here. And the last thing, just to make this statement publicly, First Bank flatly denies any suggestion that there was any sort of civil conspiracy, as the term was laid out today, between First Bank and AmTrust. There is nothing in the record other than a line that Amicus counsel stuck into the order which the judge signed that can be read at all to indicate that there was some sort of a conspiracy to defeat this interest. First Bank acquired this interest, this property, through a foreclosure proceeding that was run by the book, and acquired clear title to the property through appropriate procedures. There is no evidence of the record to support that there was anything untoward going on here. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you both parties for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Court will be in recess.
All right. The court will be in recess, subject to